Welcome to Data and Perspectives as clinical investigators discuss the management of uterine sarcomas, a special audio program that was developed from a satellite CME symposium held at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology's 2019 annual meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, our faculty presented cases from their practices that served as a framework for the discussion of emerging research in the treatment of patients with uterine sarcomas. The faculty for our program included Drs. Amanda Fader, Mario Lateo Jr., Angel Secord, and Brian Van Tine. The first module focused on clinical decision-making for patients with localized uterine Leiomyosarcoma. To begin, we discussed recommendations for metastatic workup for a patient who's undergoing TAH-PSO and was found to have an 8.9 centimeter high-grade uterine leiomyosarcoma with negative margins. I asked Dr. Secord for her thoughts on the workup of this patient.
If I can get the PET covered, I typically like to do that because I feel like many of these patients are prone to or may have pulmonary metastatic disease already. So I find that to be more helpful, but often insurance companies may not cover it. So in lieu of that, if you can't get a PET CT scan, a CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis.
So Brian, you made an interesting comment in our faculty planning room before this meeting that you view people as having metastatic disease to start with, even with what appears to be early stage disease.
Based on the FIGO curves, I feel like uterine leiomyosarcoma is one of the most aggressive of the sarcomas. And I think maybe because of its retroperitoneal location that there seems to, stage one disease in most other sarcomas, though you really can't compare FIGO staging with normal staging, shouldn't look like it does. And so because of that, it's almost more like Ewing's or rhabdomyosarcoma, where we should be doing something, but I don't think we know what to do.
So another issue, and I should say that as part of our effort to work with docs in practice, we were asking them also about sarcomas to see if we could get some ideas about what we ought to ask about. One of the docs, Amanda, brought up the issue, and we asked the audience about in terms of lymphadenectomy in patients. Most of the audience says they don't do it. Amanda, can you talk about how you approach these patients?
Yeah, I usually don't perform lymphadenectomy routinely, but if there are enlarged lymph nodes, I mean, we know that rarely these tumors can go, because they are retroperitoneal, sarcomas can go to the retroperitoneal space, whether they involve the lymph nodes or not. But routinely, there's no evidence at this time to really support doing the routine lymphadenectomy in this population.
So, Mario, we asked the audience also, okay, the workup's negative for metastatic disease. What would you be thinking about as an overall strategy in terms of adjuvant therapy? Would you consider adjuvant chemo? Would you consider adjuvant radiation therapy? And about half the audience says they would not use any type of adjuvant therapy. Well, a fair number of people consider radiation therapy to the pelvis, chemotherapy. Mario, in your practice, are there situations where you use adjuvant therapy?
No, for completely resected Leiomyosarcoma, sarcoma, it's our practice at our institution not to give any adjuvant therapy, including aromatase inhibitors if they're ER positive. So none of the data currently supports any additional adjuvant therapy for completely resected Leiomyosarcoma. Sarcoma. There's a debate about if they're morcellated, whether you would do something there, but again, if it's completely resected, there's no data to support any adjuvant therapy currently for uterine leiomyosarcomas.
So I should mention that we gave this clinical survey also to our faculty, and I'm picking out some of the instances where people had maybe differences of opinion. And I see, Brian, you checked off radiation therapy to the pelvis. What's your thinking?
Well, I'm usually downstream of all of this since I'm more of a metastatic sarcoma doctor, but I've seen a number of cases where radiation's been either recommended or considered. And so I always think that this is a conversation that should be had. But in a completely resected patient, I agree, no radiation should be given, but there's a lot of times where you're not completely resected.
So we want to get into sort of how this plays out in clinical practice. And we have a case, this is actually the case that we based some of these questions on. But Mary, can you go through how this patient presented and what happened?
Yeah, this is actually a recent case that was referred to us. She was menopausal, but in her 50s still, and a year ago had an ultrasound for somewhat of an unclear reason that showed a posterior uterine myoma. A follow-up ultrasound, she's completely asymptomatic. A follow-up ultrasound was done over a year later, which said that this had grown. And again, growing fibroids in a menopausal female should make everyone take a pause. It's probably not a fibroid. MRI was done then, it was 3.4 centimeters, and they felt it was just a myoma with degenerative changes. We did a serum LDH, and she came with these markers already. at that point was referred to us, and we repeated the MRI in December, 5 months later, and this mass had grown to a nearly 9 centimeter mass with multiple features concerning for sarcoma, including the heterogeneity, central necrosis, as well as the irregular borders, things that our radiologists have published on, and they're actually quite good at giving me a concern for sarcoma or not. And our LDH, which we do routinely now, we do MRI, LDH, all patients refer to us because we are a referral center, and most of the time they're not your routine pelvic masses coming to us. And the LDH rose. So at this point, we decided to proceed with surgery.
Hold on a second. I'm just going to go to Amanda and ask any thoughts about a patient who presents like this to you.
Peripostmenopausal with a rapidly enlarging mass and increasing LDH, and the findings on MRI done at a very good imaging center are concerning for malignancy.
So she went to surgery, Mario?
Yes.
And what happened?
We actually decided to open her because of the concern for sarcoma. Everyone's aware of the morcellation story. So with an MRI that's suspicious and a rising LDH, actually, I mean, it pretty much screamed sarcoma until proven otherwise. So we did an open procedure, did a TAHBSO via laparotomy.
So I'm kind of curious, Angelus, if you saw a patient like this and you heard the surgery and the tumor described, microcharacteristics with tumor cell necrosis, mitotic rate, if this patient said, what's the chance that this tumor is going to come back and be a threat to my life, what number or range would you give to them, Angelus?
I'm throwing out a number, I'm not sure, but maybe 50%. And Mario probably knows that better than me, that correct number. But what I do with these folks, and I would love your thoughts on this, Mario, is you all have this nomogram for survival, and you can just pull it up online. Is that still relevant? I think it's helpful in terms of counseling, and it's a survival nomogram.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about your discussions with this woman. You know, was she thinking that maybe she was going to get chemotherapy? Has she read up on it? How did she feel? Because you recommended no therapy at this point, in spite of significant risk of relapse.
So in terms of the nomogram, we still have it available online. It's available to everyone if you go to our website. There are a few nomograms on there. We are needing to update it based on some more relevant features, and there was a whole low-grade, high-grade as one of the factors that was factored in. So we will be updating that at some point when one of us gets around to having the time to do
yeah,
it, I guess.
I saw your look there.
Yeah. The thing with the nomogram, it can give you a predictive prognostic number, but it unfortunately doesn't tell you what to do to alter that number. So that's limitations with any nomogram. So, you know, after we did the surgery, I already kind of let her know ahead that I was highly concerned for a malignancy. So when I actually told her, she was kind of, I figured that's what it would be. And then our discussion was that, you know, it was cleanly resected. There was no disease in the abdomen. We then did the CAT scan afterwards, not to delay any further, which we probably should have done beforehand in retrospect, but that's fine. It turned out to be no metastatic disease. And we have a clear conversation with them that in a stage one, confined to the uterus, with no metastatic disease, there is no current role for adjuvant therapy, and so we initiated her on observation.
Brian, what are some of the key factors you consider in trying to give a patient or trying to estimate the risk of relapse?
I think the things that jump out to me as most important are size, mitotic rate, and margins. I find it interesting, and I think one of the questions that I would pose to the group just for my own interest was, well, what if she had metastatic disease? Would you have operated?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, no, I was curious also because Mary was saying that she did not have a workup prior to, would you have generally, Angelus, done a workup for metastatic disease in a patient like this before going to surgery?
Was that high index of suspicion and how her ultrasound appeared? Yes, I would.
So again, Angelus, any thoughts about what you look at when you try to determine what the patient's prognosis is going to be?
I would totally agree with what Brian said. Mitotic rate, the size of the tumor, and then also with the uterine lamellar sarcoma, whether there's extension and involvement of the serosa, I think is potentially key as well. You know, other nexal structures, but those are probably the biggest areas I would consider.
So before we go into the next case, just a couple general questions. We asked the audience, first of all, Amanda, the question of does the audience generally use some type of neoadjuvant chemotherapy in patients with large but localized sarcomas? And the audience rarely or ever does that. We also asked them about neoadjuvant radiation therapy, and again, very uncommon. Again, what about neoadjuvant therapy, Amanda? Any situations where you might consider it?
Yeah, only rarely at our institution, given these patients are often very symptomatic. They may or may not be bleeding, and they can usually be surgically resected. And we know that for uterine sarcomas and any soft tissue sarcoma, that surgery is the cornerstone of treatment. But there's obviously exceptions to that rule. And so patients who are medically inoperable, you know, saddle embolus, recent MI, or have widely metastatic disease that we not deem to be resectable, you know, certainly one can consider neoadjuvant treatments in that setting.
So I was asking Brian, because we have another CME series going on right now on soft tissue sarcomas. And there, Brian, you see a fair amount of neoadjuvant chemotherapy, radiation therapy. Why is it that it's used in these extremity sarcomas, for example, and not, for example, this situation?
I think that there's an extremity literature that's actually quite extensive that shows that in the right patient population, you actually get clinical benefit. I think it's interesting, we do not have the same literature to support the use of either radiation or chemotherapy for retroperitoneal tumors, uterine or not. And so from that standpoint, the standard of care is very, very dependent on good surgeons.
So question from the audience, Amanda, in terms of neoadjuvant therapy in the patient to try to, you know, make the patient more easily operable, to downstage the patient. Any situations where that occurs in your practice, Amanda?
Are you talking about radiation or chemo?
Either one.
So not usually with radiation, but certainly in a patient who has widely disseminated disease, it's the consideration of our sarcoma center at my institution that if we can reduce that disease burden, it can render, in several cases, a patient more surgically amenable to resection.
Mario, you know, you hear, for example, sometimes with pancreatic cancer, they give neoadjuvant therapy to try to shrink it down, pull it away from the vessels. Any situations where that occurs with uterine sarcoma where really it would help to have tumor shrinkage prior to surgery?
Yeah, the problem, as Amanda alluded to, is that these patients tend to have pain, and the bigger they get, the more pain and bleeding they have. So your response rates are 30, maybe 40% if you look at gemdosi, but you don't get that response quick enough to manage the patient's symptoms. So we really rarely do we use any neoadjuvant approach, and we will proceed if it's totally pelvic disease to surgery to resect it. And again, these patients, when they get bigger, where this might even be an issue, their symptoms are very hard to manage while you await a potential response, which isn't as great as one would think.
So this case that you just presented, did this woman, it was a pretty big tumor, did she have pain?
No, this was all
completely asymptomatic.
One of those weird things, she'll tell her friends every day now to get an ultrasound every day of their lives, of course, because of her experience, but that's not what we're trying to say here.
Right. So let's go on to the second case, and we put this case together. A lot of these questions are not exactly like the case, but sort of tries to get to the essence. And I think it was Angelos brought up the question, or actually a couple times it's already been brought up, what about the patient with a large primary but who has metastatic disease? So we'll hear in a second about this woman in her mid-40s who had a single lesion in the right hepatic lobe. We said for the purpose of this question, okay, the biopsy shows metastatic disease. And Amanda, the most common approach in the audience is to go for surgery, take out the primary, resect the liver mass, and then give chemotherapy, which is interesting. So I guess you could say pseudo-adjuvant chemotherapy, since she has metastatic disease, but yet if she would be rendered free of disease. Amanda, again, how do you approach a patient like this where there's a suspicion, or in this case, it's documented, a liver mets, but the bulk of the tumors in the uterus?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my practice, I agree with that 66% majority, and it really depends on the institution and the surgeon and their experience and comfort with doing radical resections outside of the uterus. But again, there's no modality, in my opinion, that's better than surgery. So when you can do it, it's important to really seriously consider, as long as the morbidity of the patient does not outweigh the resection risks.
Brian?
So I'm other. And so I'm the 2%, but I'm also probably the only medical sarcoma doctor in the room, hopefully. If not, hello. I actually flip it. So with surgery first, then chemotherapy, followed by resection, because the chemotherapy will, one, allow the patient, if they don't respond, to declare whether or not they're going to have multiple other things come up right behind it. And two, you know, if the chemotherapy isn't working, I cut it. And you can tell that only when there is a lesion. And so we've actually published our series.
So you're saying you take the primary out.
Take the primary out.
And then give the chemo?
And before we damage the liver.
I mean, seems like maybe while you're there, it might be tempting to get it. What do you think about that strategy? And what's your experience in general with oligomets, Angeles?
All right, this is a really interesting case. I actually answered other because I felt like there wasn't enough information for me to make a decision. I would want to know where that single lesion in the liver, where it was located, what was the size. In terms of the uterine mass, I mean, these leiomyosarcomas can get incredibly large. They develop a vascular parasitic blood supply. They're not easy. And I've been in situations, too, where you do a big resection and the patient actually has progressive disease at their post-op visit. I mean, I don't know how many of you in the audience have these big cases and within 4 to 6 weeks, they already are developing progressive disease. They can be really aggressive tumors. So I wish we could figure out which one was going to be less aggressive or more aggressive. So when I saw this case, I wanted to look at those things. If it looks like it's easy to get out and that liver disease is really small, then go for it. But if it looked like it was going to be a large, really nasty, challenging resection, I might be more cautious and consider chemotherapy first. And then the other thing I thought of too is, well, depending on the size of the liver lesion, sometimes we often forget our interventional radiologists can help with that in terms of cryo or other modalities to treat the metastatic disease in the liver.
That's a really good point. Well, let's move from the hypothetical to the reality of this second case of a woman in her 40s, Mario. What happened?
You all know I'm at MSKCC, so you can all imagine what we did. It wasn't chemo. All right, so this is another lady came to me from Midwest, and she was gravity zero, wanting to have children, very healthy, but was having significant menorrhagia. She had a prior myomectomy in the past and a left ovary taken out for benign disease. She had DNC at the time of having her menorrhage and a polypectomy, which actually diagnosed her leiomyosarcoma in the uterus. CT scan showed a 1.2 centimeter lesion in the right hepatic lobe. MRI in March of 2017, it was a 3.7 fundal mass, which was considered suspicious by our radiologist on MRI, as well as a 2.8 centimeter anterior mid-vaginal mass. She also had a cervical mass, all suspicious for malignancy. So what do? We have a conversation with her. There's no right answer for these cases, as you all know. So we did biopsy the vaginal mass because, you know, if it was a sarcoma for sure, it would have been a pretty extensive surgery. Because sarcoma surgery, you want to get a nice clean margin, a clean resection. You don't want to morcellate. You don't want to chop things up. You don't want to compromise on your margin. So that would have factored more into my decision of whether I would try surgery first or not, if it was going to be entailing possibly bladder resection and things like that. So we did actually biopsy the vaginal mass. With interventional radiology, it came back to smooth muscle tumor, which is myxoid changes, not sarcoma. We did an MRI of abdomen and pelvis, and again, they felt that the segment 8 hepatic lesion was metastasis.
Just to be clear, though, the vaginal mass, was it malignant?
It was no. Biopsy was felt to be just a benign smooth muscle tumor. But again, there can be sampling error, of course. You know, that's why we don't normally sample these leiomyomas to get diagnosis, because of the high sampling error. So we rarely biopsy a uterine mass like this to see if it's sarcoma or not. But we did that because it would have altered my surgical thinking, most likely, not so much the liver lesion. After we did this workup, the vaginal mass was stable. Her masses in the uterus were growing. She continued to have bleeding. We knew about the liver lesion. You know, she was symptomatic enough that we were going to take the uterus out anyway. So we had our liver surgeon come and give us a hand, and we did an laparotomy, no MIS surgery for these cases.
What kind of symptoms did she have from the primary?
Just bleeding.
Just the bleeding. No pain?
No. Just bleeding. She was just having a lot of bleeding pretty much nonstop. Not really requiring transfusion or anything like that. You know, we checked those things, but just constant sort of spotting and bleeding. So we did a laparotomy, did TH, right salpingectomy. She wanted to keep her ovary that she had, so we retained that for her. We resected the vaginal mass also, which was not easy to do from that angle. And then the segment A hepatic wedge resection took all of 30 minutes for our liver surgeon to do, so that's what we did. And the pathology, the only sarcoma she had was a leiomyosarcoma in the uterus. The vaginal mass was benign on final pathology, just a myxoid leiomyoma. And her liver mass actually was focal nodular hyperplasia, which I always use lots of cases to show that you can't rely on imaging so heavily like we do. The best diagnosis is a tissue diagnosis. So to alter your plans just based on imaging sometimes, I think you can make some mistakes in judgment. That's just a word of caution. So I never go just by imaging. If I find something and it's not obvious that it's metastatic, you know, either surgery or a biopsy of some sort before you make your decisions. As you can imagine, we offered no further therapy, and she's been a year and a half without disease.
Amanda, any comments about how you might have managed it? Any comments about the course of this patient?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was managed well. I'm curious, Mario, do you know what the estrogen receptor status was on this tumor?
Nope, and we didn't even check.
Okay. So it's something that can be routinely checked at institutions. The literature about whether to perform bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy in this population is very unclear. Most of the studies are retrospective or small institutional or SEER-type database studies, which don't offer the full picture. So I would be curious to know that in this younger patient, as, you know, empirically there could be some benefit to, you know, removing an ovary in a setting where a patient has a strongly estrogen-positive tumor.
Let's move on to the third case. We put out this to the audience, Mario. Woman in her 50s, has a 5.3 centimeter, we said ERPR positive, uterine Lyomyosarcoma, sarcoma, diffuse severe atypia, coagulation, tumor cell necrosis, and the mitotic rate of 27 over 20. We asked the audience about adjuvant therapy, and interestingly, most of the audience would use some type of adjuvant therapy, either chemotherapy and or radiation therapy. Brian, any thoughts about adjuvant therapy in the patient in this situation?
So I think I might be working at Memorial soon, just because I don't feel like there is a role for adjuvant anything in uterine leiomyosarcoma based on current data, which is unfortunate. I think we need something, which is why I think a lot of people are inclined to try to give something.
So speaking of trying to give something, I guess one of the things I was curious about, we certainly have done a lot of CME programs over the years on hormone therapy of breast cancer. So we said, Angelus, okay, this patient does not wish to receive adjuvant chemo, more than likely probably wasn't even offered, but would consider oral endocrine therapy. Would you recommend it? And actually, the vast majority of the audience, Angelus, says yes, mainly an aromatase inhibitor. So Angelus, agree or disagree with the audience?
Well, I think it's an option, but it's really interesting in what we discussed earlier. And Mario, you were one of the authors on the paper regarding the prognostic association of ER and PR receptors and survival outcomes. But that doesn't necessarily equate that you're going to get a benefit from utilizing a therapy to target the hormone. So there's this desire to do something, and for the most part, AIs are not overly toxic. There's some things you need to really think about. For instance, with AIs, you need to be concerned about osteopenia and osteoporosis to do DEXA scans and to treat appropriately, and that can be somewhat complicated, but I don't think we really have the right answer here. However, there's this desire to want to do something. So further work needs to be done in terms of determining if those ERPR receptor status findings are actionable in terms of treating.
So Amanda, any thoughts about adjuvant endocrine therapy? It's pretty frustrating. I'm sure patients, you know, more educated and looking stuff up and sees what kind of prognosis there is not to do anything. Might be tempting to use hormone therapy, less toxic, but certainly not non-toxic, aromatase inhibitors, you see arthralgias, other problems, tamoxifen, et cetera. What about adjuvant hormonal therapy, Amanda? Ever use it?
I do, and I have great respect for my colleagues who are absolutely right that there's, I can't quote you the data, but in almost every other tumor type where you have strong ERPR positivity, these are actionable receptors, right? We know this from other disease types. And we know with rare tumors that just because there isn't data, we sometimes with rare tumors have to use empirically good judgment to make decisions. And these have a 70% risk of recurrence. As Brian mentioned earlier, highly aggressive tumors. So I might be in that category. Do I sleep better at night? Am I doing it for myself? Maybe. I'm trying to study it at our institution. I know many others are too. But the data is just not there in the early stage localized setting. But we do counsel the patients about it as an option. And many of these patients don't really live long enough to get to develop osteopenia long term because they don't tend to do very well. So
Brian, I was just flashing on the fact that I actually started my CME company about 30 years ago when I made a videotape about endocrine therapy of breast cancer because I was so impressed with tamoxifen at that time. And we certainly talked about endocrine therapy of breast cancer a million times since then. And in the faculty room, Brian said something I never heard before about endocrine therapy and P53 and why you think it doesn't work in sarcomas.
I actually want to jump actually back to the sarcoma TCGA project for which I actually led the leiomyosarcoma section. And it was our conclusion that the ERPR myometrial signature of uterine leiomyosarcoma was reflective of tissue of origin and not the biology of the tumor. And I found it fascinating that if you actually get into the letrozole project that was done in neoadjuvant breast cancer, the patients that didn't respond all had P53 mutations. One of the most common mutations that's in this tumor are P53 mutations. And so you can kind of predict the opposite, which is these tumors should not respond because they're actually wired to divide and they're not hormonally driven anymore. I don't know what the right answer is. I usually don't get to make this decision. This is a decision made before people get to me. And so I can be much more of an armchair cowboy here. And so there's no right or wrong answer, but I don't think biologically we have, even in clinical trials that Suzanne George has done.
You don't feel that Suzanne George's data showed
it was negative.
The clinical benefit. I mean,
actually, I think it was the opposite.
I mean, 54% showed stable disease in that population for a good number of months, and then there were three patients on that
trial. But is that clinically meaningful?
That were on it for 24 weeks or longer.
But one thing just to clarify, this is the thing that Brian said that I have never heard. You said, and tell me if I got this right, okay, you said that 25% of breast cancer patients have P53 and they don't respond to hormones even if they're ER positive?
Yeah, that's the group that doesn't respond. And so this gets much more complicated in terms of using genomics to make clinical decisions, and this is in primary tumors.
Just a couple of follow-up questions. Mario, question from the audience. Would you offer robotic surgery for something that is localized in the uterus and suspicious of LMS?
The question really is MIS surgery, whether it's a robot or not, it's a separate thing. It's all about minimally invasive surgery. Well, it depends. You have to use some judgment there. If you think you can extract the specimen and do the surgery with an intact resection, clean resection, and extract it cleanly, then yeah. But, you know, that starts with an individualized situation. You have to examine the patient, her pelvis, how the mass feels, and can you really get it out? And if there's any concern about getting it out vaginally, I don't mess around. And just for these rare tumors, there's no reason to mess around with MIS. We do MIS when we go back after an SCH or supracervical or myomectomy and there's no disease there. Those we routinely will go back with an MIS approach. And I happen to use a robot, so it'll be robotic. But for those cases, again, the key comes down, it's sarcoma. You don't want to chop up sarcoma. Sarcoma surgery is intact, negative margin resection, period, end of story. So if you can do that safely with smaller incisions, that's a plus. But the primary goal is to get it out intact and safely for the patient.
In the next module, we discuss sequencing and selection of currently available therapeutic options for metastatic uterine leiomyosarcoma. To begin, I asked Dr. Van Tine for his thoughts on a recent press release on the Phase 3 announced trial evaluating the addition of olaratumab to doxorubicin for patients with metastatic soft tissue sarcoma, which did not meet its primary endpoints of overall survival in the full study population or in the leiomyosarcoma subpopulation.
When the announced trial was announced, that was a bad day in my clinic and on Twitter. And so the Phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled trial was negative, which proves that if you continue and equal out the doxorubicin in both arms and give an ineffective agent, they've divided this up for every subset. This was enriched for leiomyosarcoma, and there was no survival advantage in either arm. In fact, it was actually tilted slightly towards placebo. And so the EMA and the FDA have come out with statements saying that olaratumab should not be given to patients with soft tissue sarcoma, but the patients that are on it can continue. And so standard of care now reverts to October 18th, 2016, which is the day before olaratumab was approved and when we were still fighting about whether or not to give doxorubicin or doxorubicin and ifosfamide. So we're back in 2016.
So let's talk about some of the questions that come up in terms of that. I was also curious whether the audience had anybody who's on olaratumab, and actually about a quarter of the audience still has a patient on Olara. I'm just kind of curious, Brian, if you had a patient who was on Olara for metastatic disease, they're tolerating it well, would you continue it?
So based on the data that just came out, fortunately for me, most of my patients were on trial at the time and opted to come off. I still have two patients on a GEMTAX backbone blinded Olara trial that continued on. But in general, both the EMA and FDA have said you can continue it in people that think they're benefiting, but you shouldn't start it.
So, of course, hard to tell whether somebody's benefiting when they're also getting chemo. But in any event, let's talk a little bit about, you know, clinical management issues. And this is based on Angela's first case, a woman in her 30s who has surgery for a high-grade lesion, actually gets adjuvant doxorubicin and pelvic radiation therapy, and then a year later develops biopsy-proven recurrence. And we asked the audience what they would generally do. Amanda, the audience seems strongly in favor of docetaxel gemcitabine. Agree or disagree?
I think that's very reasonable.
So then we also asked, you know, we kind of wanted to see how people sequence patients. So we said this same patient, remember, adjuvant doxorubicin, now let's assume gem docetaxel, that was what the audience mainly would say, what's next? And you can see there's a consensus, just kidding. If you go to five different doctors, you might get five different answers. Mario, can you sort of sort through these answers and kind of what answer you would give?
Well, she already received doxorubicin before?
Doxorubicin, gem,
same case.
Docetaxel, what's next?
Well, we'd probably go to something else. I guess usually trabectedin or pazopanib is what we usually think of depending on patients dosing the drug and toxicities. So those would be our next two choices. A lot of this is not my choices, it's Dr. Hensley. She's our boss for sarcoma chemo, just so you all know.
Can I just point out to the audience that in the medical oncology sarcoma literature, the sequential use of doxorubicin followed by ifosfamide gives the same overall survival as combination therapy without the toxicity? Just looking at the number of people who are going to use AIM.
Angelus, would you like to respond to that?
So, because the AIM use was so low?
No, it was high.
Oh, it was high. Oh, you felt it was higher.
As opposed to single agent dox.
Oh, yeah, piece of dox. Okay, so I rarely use AIM. And if I'm going to use it, it's going to be somebody who's very symptomatic, who has a good enough performance status to get it. And you also have to be very careful about their other comorbidities. So do they have renal insufficiency? Have they been radiated before? And so forth. And typically, I would do single agent doxorubicin. This situation is different. She got doxorubicin for adjuvant therapy because this was pre-GOG 277 result release. And she was so young. And it was kind of like, you know, you're a little desperate. And if I were to have her walk in my office today, her treatment would be completely different.
So, and I'm curious also, Angelus, you were mentioning a little bit about in the faculty room, in the academic setting that you're in, where do you leave and the medical oncologists come in? Do you treat metastatic disease or refer them as soon as they get mets?
So this has also changed dramatically. When I first started in GYN oncology, we didn't have a sarcoma center. We didn't have a medical oncologist that specialized in sarcoma. So we were basically doing treatment. And in the GYN oncology group, I feel like there was a lot of influence from Dr. Hensley's work and interest in gemcitabine and docetaxel. So that was my first go-to choice at that point. And if they failed that therapy, then it was doxorubicin. And quite frankly, there weren't a lot of options. It was dacarbazine, and there wasn't the pazopanib, there wasn't the trabectedin, there wasn't eribulin. There's very limited options for these patients. And then I can't remember how long it's been now, but Dr. Richard Rydell is at our center, and Brian knows Rich, actually. And he's already asking me to invite him so he can, you know, I need to ask Rich to invite Brian, apparently, so he can come to Duke and give us a talk. But we love to have you over there. It's great. What's awesome for us is having the medical oncologists in this field giving us input about how we treat. Because, you know, now I know that our doxorubicin dose was too low. Instead of 50 milligrams per meter squared, it should be 75 milligrams per meter squared and so forth. So I'll get to your point. So I'm getting there. I'll treat with the initial two lines of therapy. And then if I get in a situation where they're still progressing, I don't hesitate to reach out to Dr. Rydell in our sarcoma center for assistance.
So before Brian comments, can you kind of just run through the case in terms of what actually happened with this woman? Yeah.
So this was a woman in her 30s who was thought to just have a leiomyoma by her gynecologist. And she underwent TLH-BSO and morcellation of the uterus to allow for vaginal removal. It was bivalved. And her pathology demonstrated a high-grade leiomyoma sarcoma. She presented for consultation regarding management options. So we went through all the options with her. The CT scan was negative for metastatic disease. And as I said, if she were to walk in my office today, she'd be treated very differently. But she was treated with adjuvant doxorubicin followed by whole pelvic radiotherapy. And she did quite well for just a little bit of time. In May, she already had new retroperitoneal adenopathy. She then was treated with gemcitabine and docetaxel. The CT scan showed worsening disease, and then she received pazopanib, and CT scan showed a mild decrease in the size of her retroperitoneal adenopathy. This is the CT scan from May reflecting the periodic node distribution. The PET scan shows that it's hot. And in August, despite therapy, she had increasing disease.
Mario, any comments about the issue of the morcellated patient? I don't know how often you see this or you've seen that in the last year or two.
Hopefully we're seeing less of it with all the morcellation issues that were brought to light years ago. We still get them, and not for nothing, a myomectomy or supracervical hyst is a morcellated specimen, in my opinion. So we get those more than someone had an intraperitoneal morcellated mass through the morcellator. So we routinely will take them back to take the cervix out, do an abdominal inspection, and if there's any disease there that's resectable, we will go ahead and resect it.
When was the last time you did that?
I was looking through all the cases in preparation for this about a year and a half ago. Somebody had a super cervical, came to us and we did that. And then she had residual in the, near the cecum and we resected that.
Angela, any general comments to follow up what Mario just said in terms of your experience?
I agree. Thankfully, we don't see this as often. I definitely haven't seen a power morcellator case ever since that warning came out. And what I have seen is situations where the generalist wasn't aware of what they were getting into, and either they were doing a laparoscopic hysterectomy or a vaginal hysterectomy, and they bivalve the uterus and the vagina, and that's basically kind of the same situation. So I think it's reasonable to approach it from an imaging perspective and then resection if there's residual disease.
Brian, I'm kind of curious, any comments about the case? And from your point of view, and you know, I know we just did, again, another series on soft tissue sarcoma. We had a faculty of 8 sarcoma investigators, and they all felt very strongly the patients with soft tissue sarcomas have to have input from a tertiary center. They don't necessarily need to go there, but, you know, like running a case by someone on email, et cetera. How does that apply to uterine leiomyosarcoma, Brian, in your point of view? What kind of case should trigger running it by a tertiary care center?
Well, I think that one of the things I'd like to point out, there's a paper that came out of WashU by Sarah Lang, who is now in Kansas City, who was one my postdoc and then a fellow, and she was amazing. But what she found, and I think what drives our practice, is that the clinical trial opportunities for uterine leiomyosarcoma patients are incredible. Except I hold them and they're not in the gyn-onc department. The amount of clinical trials that these patients are qualified for is insane. Front line, second line, third line, fourth line. This is the patient population we're looking for, that they don't get to us until you've given Gemtex, trabectedin, and doxorubicin, and then you've excluded them from half the trials. And so we like to see them early. We don't want to give chemotherapy. We're trial centers. And so to get them to us the second they're metastatic, you know, there's a new frontline trial of doxorubicin with the TNF analog. And so this is patients that are sought after. You know, enlotinib is enriched for uterine leiomyosarcoma. And so this is what we're looking for as a partnership, because we're not going to be able to give you your adjuvant therapy unless we can get these patients on trial.
So in your talk, I want to pick your brain a little bit about to get somebody on a trial or think about it. To me, you got to be a little excited about it, you know, for the patient's benefit. It's great to be able to add to the field, but to me, you want something that's exciting. So I'm going to give you a chance to excite the audience about some of the trials and agents out there. One other question about this case, Angeles. I see the patient got pazopanib. How did she tolerate it? And in general, what's your experience with pazopanib? Obviously, it's commonly utilized in renal cancer, where it kind of has a reputation of being less toxic, but what's your experience with it?
So my experience with pazopanib is mostly in ovarian cancer. We had a large trial in ovarian cancer patients with platinum-resistant disease, and essentially, the most important thing is managing the toxicities, knowing that they're most likely going to have diarrhea, so talk to them about dietary habits, give them a prescription, or talk to them about how to take Lamotil before they even leave an office, give them a prescription for an antiemetic because they may have nausea, and then long-term toxicity is going to be fatigue. It does cause quite a bit of fatigue.
And how did this patient do on the pazopanib?
She was on it for a very short period of time.
And then a disease progression. So we want to talk about your other case, or the second case. And we asked the audience, sort of as a prelude, what their second line therapy is if the first line therapy is a doxorubicin-containing regimen, which sounds like maybe wouldn't be the case. But in any event, the most common answer, docetaxel, gemcitabine, Mario. But then we also asked the question, what about probably a much more common situation where the patient gets first-line therapy with docetaxel gem, and the audience is a little bit split, doxorubicin, liposomal doxorubicin, and some kind of doxorubicin variation for, you know, that's the most common answer. Mario, any thoughts about what usual second-line therapy in your immemorial?
So it's usually doxorubicin alone. The liposomal doxorubicin, we don't tend to use that often for uterine leiomyosarcs. Occasionally we'll do the combination, the AIM there. Even though the outcome overall is the same, there seems to be a slightly higher response rate with the combination. So for highly symptomatic patients, you know, we would consider a younger patient with symptoms, you want to try to get a better, quicker, higher chance of response, we'll do the combination. But generally speaking, its next step is usually doxorubicin alone.
So we asked, actually, I'm going to ask Brian about this in a second, about third line therapy. First of all, Brian, how often do people get to third line therapy in metastatic urinary leiomyosarcoma?
I would say quite often at the sarcoma centers, but not outside them.
So what about third line therapy, Amanda? We said your patient's gotten doxorubicin, gem docetaxel, certainly the two most common first and second line therapies. And audience looks like it's a little split between trabectinib, pazopanib, and a number of people saying eribulin. Amanda, any comments?
These are options. I know the progression-free survival was only a couple months better, right, and the 2 or 3 months better. So I would probably go to trabectinib next. I don't have as much experience with eribulin. It's FDA approved for liposarcomas, but not for uterine leiomyosarcomas. So I don't typically use it in my practice. But
sometimes people answer things and I hear faculty saying, nah, that shouldn't be on the list. Is eribulin something you consider in this situation?
Absolutely not.
Any evidence that's of use at all in metastatic disease in this situation?
Case reports.
Case reports. Okay. So how did this play out? These questions were based on this case and just what actually happened here.
So this is a large mass. She had actually a parasitic blood supply off the right side that was pretty extensive. So we did a significant surgical procedure and resected this mass entirely. But this patient was counseled, and we talked to her about the different treatment options, and she opted for surveillance. And she actually had a really fantastic quality of life during that period of time, which leads me to pause about the whole question of adjuvant therapy. And then in December, she had evidence of an enlarging pelvic lymph node. We did an echo that demonstrated her EF was adequate for treatment. And what was interesting here is, and I'm not quite sure why the CT scan was obtained, but it was just to get a new baseline. And that showed just really rapid increase in the serosal and peritoneal implants. And it was striking to me is how aggressive these sarcomas are. So at that point in time, she was treated with doxorubicin and Elara. And she had 3 cycles of therapy, and CT scan initially demonstrated stable disease. She got 3 more cycles, and her CT scan showed a possible new left pelvic node sidewall, but she was completely asymptomatic, and she opted for short-term surveillance. So then in November, she already had increasing size of peritoneal implants. She got gemcitabine and docetaxel for 3 cycles, and then in February, rapid progressively disease present, and trabectedin was recommended. Trabectedin is difficult to dose. I'd like to hear the panel's experience with it because we have challenges with the infusion and how to get that covered and so forth.
So, Amanda, any comments about your experience with trabectedin in terms of tolerability, side effects issues?
I mean, very similar to what Angela's just said. I think it's, in my limited practice, you know, more tolerable than the pazopanib for many patients because of the terrible GI side effects. But
Brian?
So it's the king of trabectedin in the room. I like this drug a lot. I give this a 24-hour outpatient infusion on a pump. My argument with the pharmacist is if you can do a home 5-FU infusion for 5 days, you can do trabectedin for 24 hours.
Blinatumomab for ALL, 24 days.
No, but I mean, this is the fight that's happening in the hospitals, which I think is silly. The one thing I caution everybody is you should probably give trabectedin with somebody who gives trabectedin. The second they start complaining of mild muscle cramping in their legs, they're probably in florid rhabdomyolysis. And if you don't recognize it early, they end up in an ICU. And this is, you know, that 10% of patients that do badly, you have to remember to watch for heart failure on trabectedin, whether or not it's caused by it or the doxorubicin, we're not really sure. But if you're not using it all the time, this is something you probably want to partner with, but I use it all the time.
Brian, could you comment on your clinical experience with rhabdomyolysis? How do the patients present, and what do you do?
They start with achiness, and then they end up in an ICU. I've never seen higher CK levels than you do with trabectedin when it goes south.
How high?
50,000.
Wow.
I mean, it's amazing the muscle breakdown. And this is the danger of trabectedin. I mean, pazopanib comes with, you know, the black box warning for hepatotoxicity. Trabectedin, you have to be very careful to listen to your patients and not blow off early rhabdo.
So, Mario, we asked the audience, would you order next generation sequencing? You know, Foundation One's an example of a test that's assay that's commonly utilized. And it looks like, first of all, almost half the audience has already done it, and for most of the rest of them, they would certainly consider it. You kind of get that answer when you ask oncologists almost every solid tumor when they start running out of options that are approved or useful even before they might start looking at it. How productive that might be is a question, but I think Angela's case is going to sort of get into that. So one thing just to precede Angela's case that we ask, and maybe Amanda, you can comment on this. We work a lot with your lung cancer people at Hopkins, and we talk about rare disease. ALK-positive lung cancers, I think 3% of lung cancer, yet there's now, you know, a bunch of phase 3 trials, you know, it's going to the third generation. But the question is, what if you have a patient with uterine leiomyosarcoma, you do NGS, and you find an ALK rearrangement?
Yeah, I'm
so sorry. Same thing. Would you give an ALK inhibitor?
I personally wouldn't, but I would refer to my sarcoma team to consider. I mean, if we can find an actionable mutation and we've exhausted all other options cytotoxically, then I think it's reasonable to consider.
So I'm going to ask Brian in a second, but Brian, why don't you comment on the three things? So we asked about ALK. Looks like a lot of the audience would be thinking about it. A lot aren't sure, including me. I'm not sure. I don't know if it's even there's any literature on it. We also see KIT mutations sometimes. Actually, Angelus's patient had it, which is why I brought up, would you use a BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase inhibitor? And the audience, again, looks like maybe the same 55% oriented towards taking a shot at treatment. A bunch of people aren't really sure. And then the other question is MSI testing. So we asked the audience, Mario, whether or not they do MSI testing. We know, and it looks like a third of the audience says yes, two-thirds say no in leiomyosarcoma. I can say that in medical oncology now, kind of I think we're moving towards certainly metastatic adenocarcinomas. If there's no other option, they're going to get MSI tested no matter what kind of cancer it is. When you start getting outside that, you know, squamous cell lung, et cetera, I'm going to ask you, Brian, do you know anything about the distribution of these three things, MSI high, ALK, and BCR-ABL or KIT mutations?
So I'm going to work backwards. I get Tempus testing now on every sarcoma patient, not because I expect to find a unicorn, but because of genetic predispositions. And I'm finding a lot more genetic predispositions in this population. A lot of them seem to be founder mutations, but we're identifying Li Fraumeni mini patients. And this, I think you cannot miss, especially in the younger uterine leiomyosarcoma patient when her relative had breast cancer. But then it comes just as part of the package, and part of the package comes with MSI testing, and so therefore, for $100, you get it all. Now, moving on to an ALK translocation, so the red herring of the entire group, if that ALK translocation is in frame, that is important. It has to be in frame. I would use the LOXO inhibitor. I have yet to find that
so
in
I will
thousands
say-
of patients.
When we were at the ASCO GI meeting in San Francisco, we had two cases presented of people with colon cancer who were on the verge of hospice with metastatic disease, who had not had MSI testing, who got MSI tested, who were positive and are in complete remission on a checkpoint inhibitor. So it's rare, but the implications are gigantic. I don't even know. I was asking the faculty, do we know whether or not there's MSI high uterine leiomyosarcoma, and does it respond to Pembro, where the indication is? Do you know him, Amanda?
I mean,
you're at the checkpoint center of the world there.
Well, our experience is that these tumors do not respond well to checkpoint inhibition and that the MSI high rate is quite low. Their mutability rate compared to melanomas and colon cancers and endometrial cancers is quite low, actually, despite the biological aggressivity. There's a very poor response rates to these agents. But there's exceptions. But.
And of course, you know, in other tumors, that's why pembrolizumab is approved, regardless of tumor type, if you have MSI-high disease, at least in the metastatic setting. Doesn't work with everybody, but seems like, you know, maybe more than half of people have significant responses. Anyhow, just to sort of, again, put a clinical flavor into this, Angelus, what happened with this woman in her 50s?
This is a woman in her 50s, and she presented with a PET avid lesion in the thorax, but also involving the uterus and colon. So CT scan, really the demonstration of something going on in the uterus led to us believe she probably had a uterine malignancy. She underwent a CT-guided biopsy of the left upper lobe lung nodule, and that sarcoma was consistent with a high-grade spindle cell neoplasm, but they weren't able to differentiate it further based on the stains. It could have also represented a pleomorphic sarcoma or a carcinosarcoma. The ultrasound shows this dominant mass to the right with heterogeneity, and again, that's a key point. If you see what they think is a fibroid, but it has these irregular borders, that should tell you that it's not just something that's benign. So because of the pathologic issues, she then underwent VATS to get additional tissue for the diagnosis. And she underwent a doxorubicin and ALERA after confirmation of leiomyosarcoma. She had a severe reaction to ALERA. We kind of live in this belt geographically that has high reaction rates, had high reaction rates to not just ALERA, but even paclitaxel. So we have to be very careful.
Well, you're in the cetuximab belt too, right?
For yes,
reactions
we were.
To cetuximab.
We didn't use it.
But so there's a reaction belt to ALERA?
Yes.
It's something's going on in that area of the country.
So let's not get too far. I mean, I know that's been thought about, like they're ticks or something. That's
fungus.
Fungus.
Okay. It's a cross-reactive IgE antibody.
That's kind of like in the mid-Atlantic or... Mm-hmm.
Yes. Our paclitaxel reaction rates are 11%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really high. So CT scan in November demonstrated new mediastinal and pulmonary mets. She underwent gemcitabine and docetaxel, essentially overall stable initially, but significant neuropathy. And then in April had worsening disease with increased nodular soft tissue component in the mediastinal masses and increased pulmonary mets. She started on trabectedin, but shortly thereafter was admitted with hemoptysis in the setting of progressive metastatic sarcoma and underwent palliative radiation. What I wanted to demonstrate here, and this was a patient that I treated in conjunction with one of my partners, and I didn't get the NGS testing, but I was really struck by these results in that it showed these different potentially targeted therapies we could utilize, because one thing that's striking to me is these patients don't do well with their current treatments, and so we really have to be thinking about how we approach Lyomar sarcoma and what novel therapies are present. And I wanted to mention one thing about the MS stability. We already talked about that most of these tumors, there's a very low frequency of MSI deficiency, but on your NGS testing, you're going to get TMB, or tumor mutational burden, and it also is very unlikely to be high.
I had never heard this thing about, you said 11% reaction to paclitaxel. Does nab-paclitaxel, is that better?
I don't use nab-paclitaxel very often, so I'm not aware of the frequency of those reactions.
I mean, it should be pretty low, but 11%, that's pretty high for a commonly utilized drug.
Yeah, typically it's like 1%.
Interesting. So Brian, on to the next case.
The 46-year-old white woman who presents for a second opinion, she had originally been morcellated for fibroids, which is something that I just find hurts. Pathology was not sent, which is something that I find hurts more. And she developed widespread abdominal and lung disease within 6 months. She first was treated with gemcitabine and docetaxel and was on it for quite a long time. I mean, truly, it's amazing how the subset of patients with uterine leiomyosarcoma will respond to gemdosi for a long time. And so she came to us looking for a clinical trial. And at that time, IMC-3G3, which you better know as olaratumab, was part of a phase 1-2 clinical trial run out of Memorial and WashU and the University of Washington and a few other places. And this is where you learn something about statistics. What does a p-value of 0.0003 mean? It means that you're that close to being 95% certain that you don't have a random result. And so since 2016, we've had an FDA contingent approval for olaratumab because it was a monoclonal antibody with relatively few side effects outside of horrific infusion reactions. And so she went on to receive 8 cycles of doxorubicin. And so one of the things you have to realize in this trial is that dox alone arm was underdosed. A lot of patients didn't get 8 cycles of doxorubicin, and more doxorubicin is just probably better, and there may be some underlying biology to that. And then she went on to have 16 cycles of olaratumab, proving that doxorubicin works. You know, the classic thing to do prior to olaratumab was to give 6 cycles of doxorubicin and stop, unless you were at MD Anderson or WashU, and then we wouldn't stop the doxorubicin. So at the time of progression, the patient was still ECOG 0. She agreed to participate in a second-line trial. And at that time, trabectedin's frontline inclusion included getting both doxorubicin followed by gemcitabine and docetaxel, unless you had uterine leiomyosarcoma and you could have done it backwards. And so trabectedin is actually approved as a third-line agent, and it comes from a C-squirt. It's been around since 1960, and I'm very disappointed that your phase 3 in ovarian cancer was negative because all clinical development of trabectedin in sarcoma has stopped because of it. So the patient went on to get 12 cycles of trabectedin before progression. And this is a nice 24-hour infusion drug, but you have to remember, we've already talked about the heart failure, the rhabdo, and the hepatitis. But you can really do well with this drug.
Brian, I just want you to relate the comment to the audience again that you made, which really kind of stunned me in the faculty room, that you attempt to get checkpoint inhibitors in patients with metastatic uterine leiosarcoma outside a trial setting.
No, you know, when I presented...
Or get them on a trial that has a checkpoint.
No, so one of the interesting things about the Alliance Sarcoma Clinical Trial is actually a uterine leiomyosarcoma patient with a complete response to dual checkpoint inhibitors, and I've actually used them quite a lot in my practice.
This is ipi-nivo, ipilimumab, nivolumab.
Yeah, with sarcoma dosing, which is the opposite of melanoma dosing, and I have a number of patients with complete durable responses at 5 years, going back to the time of the trial. And so, you know, most of them are African American or African Caribbean women, and so I don't know if that's a subset, but it may also just be my patient demographic. But these are things that I think should be further developed in the concept in the guise of a prospective clinical trial with correct markers done again, because this was one of the few things that actually had complete durable responses. And so, you know, there are two leiomyosarcoma patients in that cohort. The other one comes off trial because it's a cooperative group trial, and he had a grade 4 sodium from getting adrenal insufficiency. Also, 5 years, no evidence of disease. So what you're out there saying, monotherapy with nivolumab and pembro, I don't use them because they don't work. I agree, unless they have, you know, an underlying MSI high. But there is data, mainly that we're putting it out, or actually presenting it this year at CTOS, of the collective Midwest sarcoma group's immunotherapy response rates.
You know, this really comes up in almost every corner of oncology nowadays. We try to stay away from anecdotal medicine, but when you have somebody say something like what you just said, you know, certainly creates a lot of interest, particularly when you're running out of options.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special spin-off program from a satellite CME symposium on uterine sarcomas held at the annual SGO meeting.